Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today we will have the 10th and final part of Front Camphor by Et Volsink. On the day of his provisional release, Et was escorted by a prison guard in plain clothes to the railway station at Zutphen. He was given a single ticket to Amsterdam and a small paper sack containing those personal effects not confiscated by the military authorities. The only concession to his paucity was a new dark blue suit. He possessed no civilian clothes, which in itself was something of a luxury, since textiles were still scarce and rationed. The train journey itself was strange and awkward. Et did not feel festive or joyful at his release. Instead, he felt resentful towards the landscape he was passing through. This was no longer his country. The people in the compartments were foreign to him. Like Eskimos or Pygmies, he felt alone. There, on the train to Amsterdam, he was once again the SS officer, the Brandenburger, the faithful werewolf, and saboteur, on his solo mission into enemy territory. Finally, when the outskirts of Amsterdam came into view, then his mood briefly softened into a kind of homecoming, but that soon disappeared when he left the station to find his way to his parents' home. Et took a number 4 tram to Saarfatistra, where he eventually found the flat his parents were renting. His mother naturally made quite a fuss of their son's return. His father, however, was a man much reduced by post-war circumstance. His father's main preoccupations were trying to recover his former financial status. The Dutch authorities had stripped him of his wartime property and bank accounts. Both of Et's parents were working in low-grade positions, but his father had succeeded in negotiating the exchange of 1,000 guilder notes from a hoard carefully hidden by his wife. Dutch wartime currency was now officially worthless. The exchange had been routed through a Swiss business connection into Swiss francs, since, for whatever reason, the old currency still retained its original value at Swiss banks. In this way, Ed's father was later able to buy a house and to negotiate an appropriate job in the east of Holland, where he was born. Et was now officially a captain in the NATO liaison section of the Dutch army. However, his condition report carried the designation originated from enemy forces, leaving no one in any doubt as to his background. This designation also reduced him to the status of a third-rate officer, only to be exploited and never completely trusted. Et compared himself in this to the German rocket expert Werner von Braun, inventor of the V-1 and V-2 rocket bombs. Werner von Braun almost destroyed half of London during the war, but was accepted for service directly after his surrender by the American Military Scientific Services and eventually brought the first man to the moon. Et, however, was always considered by his employers in NATO to be a Nazi of the lowest degree, and only employable because there were practically no others of his experience available. Volsink's special military experience and expertise, together with his unquestioned anti-communist attitude, made him extremely useful in Cold War operations. Et was one of the few non-Jewish experts in Eastern Europe and East European languages. There were even fewer Jews with Volsink's expertise in military areas. There were many instructions, briefings, and innumerable small actions on both sides of the Iron Curtain. Et's connections with military intelligence services never ended, and he had sworn many oaths of silence on these activities, taking many dirty secrets to his grave. For Et, he privately only recognized one kind of oath, the oath of loyalty he had sworn to National Socialism, the Waffen-SS, and the Führer. The extorted oaths made after 1945 did not mean a thing to Et, especially as they were made in the name of a political system he despised. His situation in 1948 was a strange one, because as a former enemy, he received no regular pay except when on active service. He could claim no soldier's pension on his 55th birthday, unlike regular Dutch army officers. In fact, Het Vulsink was still active in his chosen career, well into his early 60s. Et was not, however, excluded from automatic promotion, and remained as a highest class middle rank officer available for service on cases which his younger successors could not solve. Less than 4 years after the war's end, the Dutch public and political administration was in an insane situation, where laws and decrees frequently contradicted each other. Et found himself acting as a part-time captain of the commando troops, as the authorities could not agree another more fitting title. Then he received an official letter from the Dutch government stating that he was denied the right to serve in the Royal Dutch Military Forces unless he asked for mercy from the Queen of the Netherlands. Et despised the Dutch royal family and would rather have poisoned the Queen than petition her for mercy. So in the end, he did nothing about the letter and continued to serve on the missions he was allocated. This seems to have been the correct course of action, because 2.5 years later, he was promoted to the rank of major without any kind of interference. As the years passed, and for 20 or more years, the outbreak of atomic war with the Soviet bloc remained a threat, Ed no longer served in Dutch military service, but directly under the command of NATO strategic headquarters. Back in 1948, Ed was trying to make sense of his new situation. Finally, after 8 turbulent years, he was once again a civilian. Initially, money was not a problem for him. In addition to the money he could expect to earn from NATO, he also had a secret bank account waiting for him. His father had carefully secured his son's savings during the war years. The money which Et had regularly sent home for safekeeping was not his modest regular soldier's pay, but the Gefahrengeld, the danger money he received for his special work in the Brandenburg and later in the Oranienburg. This was high-value currency, which had not been confiscated by the Allied administration. He was also luckier than most released prisoners of war in that he had a job already waiting for him. The military authorities who had recruited him decided that he must have a civilian job, both as a cover and as a means of keeping him usefully occupied between missions. The hotel business was the most appropriate for this purpose. Searching rooms, watching the behaviour of suspect guests, placing microphones or other devices, these were always good skills to develop there. The job was new to him, and had to be learned from scratch, so the authorities entrusted him to run a small 40-bed hotel, where he could learn the business from the inside. To help him master his new career, Ed sought the help of a Corsican woman he knew as a friend of his parents. The woman was married to a famous Dutch hotel expert who was imprisoned because of his cooperation with the wartime German security brigades. The woman, and later her husband after his release, taught Ed all there was to know about the hotel profession. Within a year, he had become proficient in bar work, kitchens, restaurant, and hotel administration. This had not left much time for his National Socialist duties, working around 16 hours a day for 6 days a week, but he had been able to maintain contact with former SS comrades. As part of his werewolf obligations, Et had notified the network of his release from prison and had reported himself as available for activities to the deputy of Admiral Donitz. Admiral Donitz himself was at that time a prisoner in Spandau Prison, Germany. It was ordered by the network to await further instructions and continue his regular work. In his private life, it began to pick up the pieces. Just prior to his joining the German army, he had fallen in love with a very young girl, the daughter of a tobacco manufacturer. The girl's father was a friend of Ed's and also a member of the NSB. When Ett was released from prison 9 years later, he realized that she had waited for him all those years, and they resumed their relationship. Given the circumstances, the young couple began an intensive courtship. Around the same time, Ett's boss in the hotel business decided that he could not learn any more in his present job, and together with Ett's controllers in the MID, persuaded the owner of a deluxe hotel chain to take Ett on as a trainee for larger hotel management. He started his new position in the administration department on very low pay, which created financial problems for him. The reason for this was because, as well as his normal expenses for living, Ett also contributed some of his earnings to a special support fund. While he was still in prison, the SS had founded an organization to support the invalid soldiers who were starting to be returned from prisoner of war camps in Europe and the Soviet-held territories. The situation for these men was grim indeed, as under pressure from left-wing politicians and Jewish organizations, the Western governments refused to grant pensions or financial relief to former SS soldiers, forcing their families to support them. This was even harsher than it sounds, because most governments had, like the Dutch, stripped the families of collaborators of their homes, bank accounts, and valuables. Therefore, the first task of those SS men who were free was to raise funds to guarantee food, homes, and medical treatment for themselves and their less fortunate comrades and their families. In his first hotel job, Ett had earned good money as a bartender. During this period, he had been contacted by an SS officer called Jan Hartmann, who had founded a support organization among Waffen-SS men and their families in the Netherlands. Ett willingly contributed a percentage of his earnings into the support fund, the LIOT, which was later called the HIAG, the Hilfsorganisation Org Gegenseitigkeit der Waffen-SS. The work of these organisations saved many lives and greatly helped those invalids who returned to a hostile country without homes or families. Unfortunately for Ett, when he transferred to his new job in hotel administration, his low pay left him with little money after making contributions. Yet good fortune smiled on Ett once again, as after a few months he was able to take a better paid job in the hotel reception department. This was a more responsible job, which Ett easily secured thanks to his ability to speak several languages. The duties of reception clerks third class were varied and profitable, involving daily talks with management and reception chiefs at other hotels, settling bills and registering guests. The black dollar economy of the immediate post-war period was underway in Holland. The system worked like this. Cash dollars were brought from Americans at 3 guilders 50 and sold onto the black market for 11 guilders 50, US currency being stronger than the currencies of war-torn Europe. As he usually operated on the hotel desk with an old NS colleague, Ett was able to make plenty of deals with the black dollar. Operating in conjunction with others, and under the determined leadership of Hauptsturmfuhrer Hartmann, a great financial blow was struck at the treasury of the hated regime, and at the same time, much money was generated for the SS support fund. It was with the help of a dozen or so trusted comrades that the financial problems of invalid comrades in the Netherlands were solved, until such time that the Dutch government was forced to provide them with an adequate standard of living. Yet the black dollar dealing was not without risks, and Ett and his confederates could not allow other hotel workers onto the desk positions in case the unlawful transactions were discovered. This meant working very long hours and taking part in Amsterdam's nightlife, often not seeing home or bed during 24-hour shifts. Inevitably, the pressure on Ett's private life began to tell, and his fiancée left him. Yet there was compensation in this, as he met his future wife, Maiki, some months later, and at the time of his death, they had been together over 40 years. The invalid support funds were not the only activities developed by Hartmann and his comrades. There were serious political activities to maintain National Socialist morale and reactivate the National Socialist organizations. A strong anti-democratic league was formed in the years 1949 to 1952 from within the framework of the Hartmann relief organizations, an estimated 90% of its membership being recruited from Waffen-SS veterans. Et recalled an event held in 1953 at Christmas in the Dutch Tropical Museum. This Zonnewende meeting had an audience of at least 1,000 participants. Hartmann held smaller meetings in regional centres. He imported small swastika posters from the USA bearing the German slogan Wir sind wieder da, we are here again. Subordinate groups of activists, such as revisionist writers, were funded and memorials were organized for the National Socialist dead. However, there were two highly important courses of action taken on by Hartmann and his followers, which had a major impact on post-war Holland. First of all, was the location and exhumation of the bodies of the executed Dutch National Socialist leadership and their reburial in a secret location where they would remain until such time as a dignified National Socialist funeral could be given. The most spectacular recovery was that of the body of Anton Mueser, executed leader of the NSB. On a cloudy night in a graveyard in Utrecht, the Hartmann group dug up a mass grave and sorted through the stack of six coffins, carefully opening each one and examining the corpses. They found a corpse with the area around the heart completely destroyed, so they knew that this had to be Mueser'd. All the remains were removed to a safe location where they were cleaned, preserved and reburied. The intention is still to build a mausoleum with suitable tributes, where the mortal remains of the Dutch National Socialist leaders can rest in dignity. That day has yet to come. The removal and concealment of Mueser's remains was a victory for the National Socialist underground in the Netherlands and represented the organizational ability of Hartmann's organization. The Dutch media automatically decried the action and tried to sour the victory by claiming that the wrong body had been taken, but the Hartmann groups knew otherwise. Secondly, and for the Dutch authorities more threateningly, was the campaign of revenge actions begun in 1951 against those who had figured prominently in the persecution of National Socialists in the immediate post-war period. Revenge was not the aim of the Jan Hartmann organization, but when these actions became unavoidable, they were carried out by subgroups recruited from within the Hartmann Club. The majority of the revenge wing were between 23 and 32 years of age and had seen active service during the war. The revenge wing secured the purchase of a shooting sports club in Muiden, near Amsterdam, where weapons training and shooting practice could be held in privacy and security. The selection and admission of members into the club was carefully controlled, although the Dutch security service was not as well organized or efficient as the Hartmann organizations. All kinds of weapons, ammunition and explosives were recovered from secret stocks which had been hidden or buried during the capitulation of 1945. The revenge wing was soon well equipped and ready for action. Then, the unexpected happened in the north of Holland. A former Waffen-SS soldier decided to wage his own war of vengeance. The lone veteran had lost all his family in the crude and brutal conditions of the post-war detention camps. Partially crippled by war wounds and stripped of all his savings, he had waged a one-man war of retribution. The lone SS man was living in a country district where information on locals was easily gained. The names and private circumstances of his persecutors were listed. Their daily routines were monitored and the plans were made. In one violent 24-hour period, he liquidated all his enemies and then took his own life, his mission accomplished. News of the killings was not given wide publicity and only appeared in the local press, possibly to avoid creating panic among the Dutch population. This was particularly surprising, given the wide coverage in the Dutch press at that time to so-called Nazi war crimes in the Netherlands. The Hartman groups learned of the killings through their internal networks, not through the Dutch newspapers. The news from North Holland only served to increase the desire for action among the revenge wing. There were, however, problems of strategy. In the large towns and cities, they lacked the manpower and facilities to follow and register the activities and whereabouts of all potential targets. Since most of those with paid employment were working long hours, and 6 or 7 days a week, it was difficult to find time to cover such time-consuming duties. A solution to the problem was to be found later. There were other problems for the National Socialist Underground in this period. Despite the charismatic leadership of Jan Hartman, there were rifts between the older and younger NS survivors. There were many soldiers, mainly Waffen-SS, living in Amsterdam. These men, including Ed, held meetings every fortnight, usually organized by Hartman, but also held social gatherings and house parties. These decorated NS fighters looked on themselves as superior to other political or civilian NS people. The ex-soldiers always talked about their wartime experiences, the corrupt Zionist world in which they now lived, and the amateur way in which the civilian NS colleagues were trying to fight the common enemy. Often, the SS men would exclude from their activities those who had not served on the battlefronts, or those who had served in the internal security forces and German police units, or the political paramilitary groups like the NSB, the NSKK, and the Landwacht. Ed Volsink later regretted this negative stance. "It was a terrible fault we made in the years 1950 to 1956. We should have recognized that the times had changed and that only solidarity with all branches could lead to a blockade of Zionist influences. We excluded all comrades who were at the time fit for the front, but instead served in the German police forces. We avoided inviting them to our meetings or simply ignored them. This was a big mistake. You could not have fought a clean war when there was unrest and rebellion in your hinterland." However, the time came when Ett and others had to re-examine this flawed approach. The need to recruit new activists into the subunits of the NS Underground meant that new members had to be screened to avoid infiltrators. It was then that the value of the ex-Grun Polizei and SED men was realized, as they were specialists in just such operations. Hartman himself decreed that there should no longer be any difference between those who had been front fighters and those who had served on the home front. Jan Hartman was a dedicated leader and gifted coordinator of the post-war National Socialist movement in the Netherlands. His early death prevented the unity of the various groups and allowed the fragmentation and division of those who remained after. As Ed Volsink regretted years later with hindsight, "With reserve, we remember the words of the Führer in Mein Kampf. In a National Socialist society, every man and woman will serve his people in accordance with his personal talents." Moreover, both Ed's own father and his future father-in-law belonged to the ranks of those who had not served at the front, but who had profited from privileged positions supporting the Dutch National Socialist Administration and German occupation forces. It was the realization of the worth of the former security police that provided the solution to the problems encountered by the revenge wing. In particular, was a former member of the SD who had originally served in the Waffen-SS regiment Westland, but was then ordered to resume his service with the Sicherheitsdienst alongside the German security police in Amsterdam. After the war, he was living in Amsterdam, still in contact with his former SD comrades and known to the Hartman organization as a reliable operator. These men were the obvious choice for the revenge wing, since they and their families were already financially supported by the Hartman foundations as they were out of work. In addition, they had all the necessary skills and experience, and they were loyal National Socialists. Not only that, but these men were uniquely placed in having innumerable contacts still employed in the Dutch police forces, who would either cooperate out of old loyalties or were open to blackmail over their previously undisclosed collaboration with the wartime German security services. After the initial delays, the revenge wing was able to act. The most important tactic for the revenge wing was to provide watertight alibis for all their personnel. The squads had to move with the utmost care. Even in the anonymous crowds of Amsterdam, discovery could not be allowed. Nevertheless, after the appearance of every target dead body, the Dutch police visited each capable ex-soldier to check out his story. Suspicion lingered, but proving the case was impossible. Firearms were rarely used. There were plenty of other methods. Et himself instructed the Amsterdam group in the techniques of killing silently, principally how to kill with bare hands by smashing the victim's larynx. The killings were planned as swift, honest settlements. The victims were always told the reasons for his or her execution beforehand. Such was the impact on the Dutch authorities that the Justice Department took the unbelievable step of approaching a former high-ranking Dutch National Socialist politician to try to negotiate with the unseen assassins. What the Dutch government did not appreciate was that, within the post-war NS community, all the old ranks had been abolished and authority was based on new criteria. Therefore, it took some weeks before the government approaches had fully filtered through to the revenge groups. In the meantime, the Revengers had been busy coordinating their actions, not only in the Netherlands, but slowly spreading out into the Flanders region of Belgium. The Dutch Justice Department had been surprisingly astute in their selection of Professor Godwagen as the man to be approached as a go-between to the National Socialist Underground. There was, within the Hartmann groups, a dedicated former SS man who was a friend of Professor Godwagen. Too old now for direct action, he was ideally placed to negotiate through the professor with the Dutch government. Out of this negotiating came an unimaginable offer to the NS Underground. They would get an almost free hand to eliminate hated criminals in the night and fog actions if they would spare certain important public figures who were either involved in government or corruptly connected to the establishment. The impression created was that the new ruling elite in post-war Holland wanted to shake off the resistance thugs and the black marketeers who had risen to prominence through the chaos of the war's end. The revenge actions of the NS Underground were a convenient way for the Dutch establishment to weed out its own undesirables without getting its own hands dirty. The proposals were set out on plain paper, which in turn was hand-copied by the Hartmann groups and circulated across their network in the Netherlands to be discussed and acted upon. Et recalled that he was personally intensely opposed to any kind of compromise with the ruling classes. Unfortunately, the majority of those in the Hartmann organizations had established careers and families. Now, they saw a means to secure their anonymity and exact revenge at the same time. Therefore, it was arranged that the SS veterans' leadership would meet with the government negotiators in an obscure pub with several exits in the red light quarter of Amsterdam. It was much against his will that Et Volsink took part in this first meeting. The Hartmann group pointed out to him that he had the best background for operations of this kind, and they would have the full authority of the NS Underground. So, heavily disguised and wearing flesh-coloured rubber gloves to avoid fingerprints, Et took part in the discussions. The government team produced a list of untouchables, those who should not be attacked. To Et's disgust, the list included hated figures such as the sadistic former civil commander of the Haas camp and the state prosecutor for all the top anti-Nazi cases. the man who had prosecuted Musser, an SS General Rauter of the RSHA, and many others who had rushed from one execution to another, who had authorized the firing squads, had now to be spared. It was a difficult task to honour the agreements and to keep the revenge actions going smoothly, especially since it involved groups spread throughout the Netherlands. Nevertheless, the expertise of the former SD operators shone through, and the actions were completed without breaches of security. The scale of the actions was such that at times it seemed as if old times had returned. The Dutch government was shaken by the outcry from within its own ranks. The press howled in protest, but the Dutch police acted as agreed, and nobody was caught. In addition, the limited number of unlawful actions had permitted the NS Underground to fulfill a number of other objectives. There were always reminders for Ett of his war years, both with the Brandenburg ZBV 800 and with the SS Oranienburg. While serving with Dutch military intelligence, Ett came face to face with an old adversary in the city of Bled in Slovenia, at that time part of Yugoslavia. Marshal Tito, dictator of Yugoslavia, had been a principal target of Ett's Kampfgruppe, and yet now Ett was there to negotiate with Tito's forces. Tito had broken with the Soviet bloc, and lived more like some medieval emperor than a Marxist, with a string of castles and a luxury lifestyle. Now, the NATO and American forces were seeking alliances with Tito, offering help against Stalin should the Soviets decide to attack their former ally. It was with mixed feelings that Ett contributed to the discussions, and as a National Socialist, felt nothing to be proud of in these arrangements. An area of Ett's life which the authorities had seemingly forgotten about was that with the restoration of his Dutch nationality in 1948, he had not been restored with full voting rights in Dutch elections, although he had no interest in the democratic process. It was not until some 12 years later, in the 1960s, that the Dutch authorities discovered this error on their part. What seemed to happen was that somewhere, among the dusty paperwork, someone realized that one of Holland's most useful subjects was actually deprived of the vote, and so the authorities set out to rectify the error. Ett had just returned from an undercover mission to Hungary when he received an official letter reminding him that he had been released from prison 12 years ago earlier on probation, and since this still applied, he must put himself at the disposal of a political guardian, if his voting rights were to be returned. The political guardian turned out to be Mr. Boaz, who demanded that Ett should fully acknowledge the usual terms of probation, which had not applied previously, by presenting himself at his office every week. He must also maintain a diary of his movements, which he must show to Mr. Boaz, and there were other various restrictions. Ett had also to ask and receive permission from Mr. Boaz if he wanted to travel outside Amsterdam. The final point to Mr. Boaz was that he was Jewish. Ett considered all the demands that Mr. Boaz had presented, together with his background, and he told him to check with the Dutch Defence Ministry concerning Ett's freedom of movement and actions, and then he told him to go to hell. Ett never saw or heard from Mr. Boaz again, not even when he got into trouble with the Dutch political police. It was surprisingly easy for Ett and his comrades in the National Socialist Underground to operate and keep the movement together between 48 and 1960. But then, as the 60s progressed, the situation changed. The old guard of the post-war world in the Netherlands was being replaced by politicians and power brokers with different agendas. Those who had served their time in Dutch politics as former resistance or wartime profiteers gave way to representatives of international trading companies, the largely Jewish-owned or controlled banks and finance houses, and those Dutch politicians connected to the increasingly powerful Anne Frank Foundation. Whereas the old enemies with their resistance, royalist or black market backgrounds had taken steps against those collaborators or war criminals they had fought in the war, They did not pursue them with the hatred or the vigour of the new breed of Dutch politicians. Et had numerous problems with the Dutch political police in his post-war years, despite his service to NATO. As described in previous chapters, he helped a number of his comrades in the NS underground to flee to South America and elsewhere, and the police traced some of the contacts back to Et. Et's wartime record was known to the political police in part, at least. In the 1970s, another leftover from the war years returned to bedevil Et's life. An old wound suddenly inflamed. After a lapse of almost 30 years, the bullet wound in his ankle seriously impaired Et's ability to walk and work, especially a problem in the hotel trade. He endured 6 months of increasing pain, and despite the treatments of the family doctor, he was forced to undergo surgery. Et was consequently confined to bed rest afterwards, and was able to work only via 3 different telephone lines, maintaining contact with other interests via his IPS shortwave radio. The wound then remained as a large blue-brown spot, which, while unsightly in the sauna, no longer caused him any pain. Et's political activities as an active National Socialist continued to draw him into conflict with the Dutch establishment, and many times his home in Amsterdam was raided by the police. Despite the advancing years, Et Velsink remained true to his orders as a member of Werwolf and maintained close links with the underground NS movement in Germany and across Europe. At this point, it is impossible to list the countries and organizations where the former Brandenburger had influence. Perhaps, in some future time, the whole story will be told. In the immediate post-war years, Et was living more than a double life. He was living at least a treble life. He was, in the one man, a Amsterdam hotel manager, an officer in the NATO intelligence section of the Dutch military, a veteran of the Waffen-SS, still loyal to the National Socialist cause, and working as part of the Werwolf NS underground. Et's life was complicated by anyone's standards. As the Cold War intensified, he served in undercover actions for NATO, often working with other specialists, sometimes alone, and almost always in territory controlled by Moscow or its communist allies. Although there was close cooperation between the member states of NATO, as yet the manipulation and assignment of the Special Intelligence and Operations Units was not yet coordinated from a central point. Whenever Et had to undertake a job for the Americans or the British, great pains were taken to protect and conceal his true identity and country of origin. Unfortunately, this system was not foolproof, and Et was to receive word that his movements in Amsterdam were being closely watched by agents of the Warsaw Pact. Also, in Amsterdam, it was not so easy for Et to conceal his whereabouts or his true identity, so after being warned, he used all kinds of techniques to cover his movements and brush off people he suspected were shadowing him. This was very difficult and unfamiliar terrain to Et, who was used to frontline service, not staying invisible in civilian life. He was coached in new techniques of undercover work by members of the various foreign secret services, on whose behalf he was increasingly working as a one-man show behind the Iron Curtain. In order to help himself in Amsterdam, Et made sure that he paid special attention to these lessons and developed evasion techniques quickly. What his NATO contacts did not know was that Et was going to use these new skills in the service of another cause. The surviving NS and SS networks in Holland were now getting well organized on the fringes of the Jan Hartman organization, and the planned revenge actions against their enemies in the post-war Netherlands were about to be launched. Et was heavily involved in these plans, and frequently had to visit his comrades across Amsterdam, so he used the evasion techniques whenever he went out. He would vary his method of travelling across Amsterdam, changing each time from motorcycle to taxi, tram car or train, switching the locations of meeting places. Often, the locations of the meeting places were chosen as being the most unlikely for an XSS man or soldier to frequent. Constant change and no routines were the secret to avoiding detection. For Ett, this was an exciting way of life, especially for a young man in his late 20s, recently released from the boredom of captivity after a wartime of constant action and excitement. The only disadvantage he found in this undercover existence was that the elaborate travel methods and the 10 to 16 hours, 6 days a week hotel training at the Beethoven Hotel took up so much of his valuable time. At noon, on one particular day, Ett travelled to a meeting with a small group of ex-soldiers at the house of a disabled comrade who lived on the east side of Amsterdam. The purpose of the meeting was to discuss the liquidation of a former member of the BS, the Internal Armed Forces, which had emerged to replace the resistance in Holland after the liberation by the Allies in 1945. The BS had committed many acts of violence against Dutch National Socialists and their families. The subject of the meeting on this day had been responsible for the sadistic murder of several dozen former SS men in the post-war concentration camps in the Netherlands. He had prospered in his post-war activities, and like many others in the BS, had taken over the country house of a former collaborator in a wealthy suburb of Amsterdam. The daily routines and details of his private life were known to Ett's group, who had carried out a period of surveillance on the intended target, as they did with the other enemies on the list. The surprise attack and liquidation would not be difficult, and only the date had to be fixed for the small team from Ett's group to carry out the action. After the meeting was concluded, Ett and his comrades left the house one by one. Ett walked away in the direction of Wetteringplatsen, ducking into a public lavatory to change out of his disguise, and quickly boarding a tram and back to his hotel. The tram was not very busy, and he was sat opposite a young couple. Ett studied all the other passengers carefully and returned his gaze to the couple across from him. The young man seemed familiar, but he could not remember where or under what circumstances they had met. The young man had obviously shared Ett's thoughts, as he suddenly leaned forwards and whispered the first name that Ett had used, both in the Brandenburg and later in the Oranienburg. Ett was startled, and immediately the young man's name appeared in his head. He whispered back, "Sjoki, how on earth can you be free?" Sjoki had been a member of the Brandenburg Division, and later had served with Ett under Otto Scorsini in the Oranienburg. However, unlike Ett, he did not have the protection of the RSHA false documents and had been captured at the capitulation, put on trial, and convicted of war crimes with a sentence of life imprisonment. It had been with some difficulty that he had arranged for his sentence to be served in the labour camps of the Limburg coal mines, where the cunning ex-Brandenburger had easily managed to escape and found a place to hide. Sjoki explained to Ett that he had lived an undercover life since his escape, but that he would like to settle in South America, but unfortunately he lacked the right contacts to get there safely. Ett told him that he knew how this could be done, but needed a lot of time to discuss and arrange the necessary measures. He also stressed that it was dangerous for Sjoki to be seen in his company, as he was both watched and frequently followed by hostile agencies. He arranged for Sjoki to meet him at the Beethoven Hotel, with details of how he should slip through the crowd of guests up to Ett's quarters in the attic rooms. Ett was now even more anxious than usual to avoid being seen by possible enemy agents, so he got off the tram before his destination and hurried to a neighbouring post office where he could telephone his contact in the emigration office unnoticed. Sjoki had indeed been fortunate in making contact with Ett, because Ett had many special contacts both through the Jan Hartmann organizations and more secretly through the werewolf. After he had been released from prison, the werewolf had taken the precaution of supplying him with the name and address of an institution that could provide an escape route to South America. This source could also supply all the necessary papers, the faked passports, visas and tickets, plus a contact in Buenos Aires that could take care of employment and housing at the other end. As Ett had strict orders to remain in Holland, and his circumstances were now quite favourable, he had not needed to use this loophole himself, but had been able to see a dozen or more threatened comrades piloted safely out of the country through the network. After a brief and careful explanation of the situation, the contacts promised to deliver the necessary papers and instructions to Ett at the hotel on the same day. As a precaution, they asked him to include a coded introduction in his own handwriting when sending it in. Ett acknowledged the arrangements and made his way back to his workplace. Later that day, Shirky made his way to Ett's rooms unobserved and gave Ett the full story of his post-war escape and life on the run. Ett supplied his old comrade with the travel documents and the details of the journey. He wished his friend every success, and then Shirky quietly slipped out from the hotel to make his preparations. It was about 2 months later that Ett received word from Shirky's girlfriend that he had arrived in Argentina and that she would follow to join him there as soon as she had saved up enough money for the voyage. Ett had the satisfaction of knowing that he had been able to help yet another comrade find a place of safety and promptly put the episode to the back of his mind, thinking that was the end of it. Ett thought wrong, because several months later he was suddenly arrested by the Dutch political police and taken in handcuffs at gunpoint to their central offices for interrogation. The police wanted to know all about the Shirky case. It seems that the police had raided Shirky's last address in Holland and had found notes about Ett's workplace hidden there. Ett maintained that he thought that Shirky was a free man who had served his full sentence and had no idea that the man was on the run. The police were unable to break Ett's story, and eventually were convinced by his version of events. The POD had been keen to charge Ett with deliberately helping an escaped war criminal out of the country, but they could prove nothing, and they had no further leads. Reluctantly, the police made their excuses, and Ett was given a ride home in a police car, this time without the handcuffs. He heard no more about Shirky. As Ett Volsink maintained, it is not that he had no interest in the man's achievements in South America, but life was far too short to stay in contact with all his former comrades, as he had far too much to do with the present ones. During his wartime service with the ZBV 800, Ett had been part of an escort detachment to a top-secret mission into Russia. The mission had been an organized negotiation between representatives of the Wehrmacht, Abwehr, and SS and key figures in the Red Orchestra, a Zionist partisan brigade and terrorist organization. During the mission, Ett had come face to face with Tenner, the shadowy leader of the military faction in the Red Orchestra. After the capitulation of 1945, Ett was to spend several years in assorted prison camps and prisons, little realizing that Tenner was going through similar treatment. After the victory of 1945, the Soviet authorities had arrested Tenner and incarcerated him in Moscow's Lubyanka prison, accused of anti-Soviet activities and collaboration with the Germans. When the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, had had enough of him, Tenner was released by the communist regime on condition that he would settle in Israel and stay there. The journey to Israel was made via Western Europe, which gave Tenner the opportunity to visit his daughter, who had settled in London. By this time, Ett Volsink was working for NATO in military intelligence and was asked to check out Tenner to see if he could be persuaded to disclose any secrets about his wartime activities before he left for Israel. Ett and a colleague travelled to England and visited the address their controllers had given them and gained admittance by posing as journalists. What they found was not a dangerous Zionist terrorist, but a crippled man, ravaged by a stroke and maltreatment in communist captivity. Tenner was a wreck of a man, unable to walk unassisted and barely capable of speech. He was tended by an older woman, probably one of his former wives, who seemed able to understand what Tenner was trying to say. There was little point in the mission continuing, as Tenner was useless as a source. Later, Ett learned that Tenner ended his days on a kibbutz in Israel, completely alone, after his wife had been eliminated by a special service action. She was silenced in case she revealed anything which her husband had managed to tell her. SS Sturman Jack von Spengen was buried on May 24, 1989, in a small cemetery in a small village somewhere in the Netherlands. Present at his funeral were his next of kin and about 60 or 70 men and women of the extreme right, most of them elderly. Jack von Spengen had been quite popular in those political circles. The funeral oration was given by a former military doctor of the Waffen-SS. In the post-war years, he had served as family physician to most of those present. The words of the oration were carefully chosen to express the feelings of those present, and at the same time to avoid trouble with the authorities. In the political climate of the modern Netherlands, where pro-Zionist and multiracial ethics hold sway, it is dangerous to speak favourably of National Socialism and service to its cause. The whole ceremony lasted only 1.5 hours. Then the crowd departed in all directions, leaving behind Jack von Spengen in his coffin, a lonely SS man who had devoted his whole life to National Socialism, the cause of Adolf Hitler, and the creation of the Aryan Order and a better world. Ett Volsink had stood among the crowd at the graveside to say farewell to an old comrade. He had known Jack for many years and regarded him as one of the more remarkable Dutch SS volunteers and wished that his story be included here to preserve it from oblivion. Jack, or rather Jacobus Gerardus von Spengen, was born on March 17, 1928, in a middle-class, Marxist-oriented family in one of Holland's big cities. When the war reached the Netherlands, he was just 12 years old. When it ended, he was just over 17. Not exactly a long period of war service to build up a military career, but Jack von Spengen served in the Waffen-SS and fought bravely for what he believed. Ett first met Jack in 1950, 5 years after the capitulation. They had not served together, nor met in any of the post-war camps, but had shared many similar experiences. Jack told Ett of his wartime experiences during meetings at his home and at events of various associations of which both men were members. In spite of growing up in an anti-German environment with an education to match, Jack von Spengen grew more and more attracted to National Socialism during the first years of the German occupation of Holland. As it was impossible for the young teenager to openly display his preferences before his family, he secretly joined meetings of the Jugendsturm and later the Hitlerjugend. Despite becoming a regular supporter of these meetings, it was impossible for him to join as a full member, since his father was a fervent Marxist, an outspoken opponent of the National Socialist movement who would block any such endeavours. However, Jack saw his opportunity when the wartime Dutch NSB leaders launched an agricultural enterprise in Poland. The NSB, together with the German authorities, had formed the Netherlands East Company, the NOC, which was cooperating with the Germans in creating as many Germanic farm settlements as possible in the Eastern Territories. The NOC were recruiting healthy Dutch youths up to the age of 18 to work on abandoned farms in eastern Poland. The teenage volunteers needed parental consent in order to join the scheme, but much to his surprise, Jack's father consented. He always maintained that his father still believed that the eastern regions were still loyal to Moscow. So Jack von Spengen travelled eastwards with other Dutch volunteers, both boys and girls, to farm in Poland. The farms, which had been taken over by the NOC, were subject to raids by wandering bands of Polish partisans, so the organisers of the Eastern Agricultural Scheme set out to raise their own defence force. As Jack was quite a strong lad for his age, he was asked to join with other older boys in semi-military training at improvised Hitlerjugend camps. For Jack, this was an even greater adventure and close to his heart. At the age of 15, he was carrying a K-98 Mauser rifle and protecting the Dutch farm settlements. To all appearances, he was now a German soldier. The appearance of armed defenders at the farm settlements rapidly put a stop to partisan raids, and for a time, nothing happened except farm work. But then, after the defeat at Stalingrad and the subsequent Soviet advance westwards, things began to change. By the time the Soviets had reached the old Polish-Soviet border, the threatened farms had been evacuated. The civilians and younger workers returned to the Netherlands, but the older boys with military training were held back. The Dutch volunteers were asked to join the SS division Bomen Maren as regular Waffen-SS soldiers. This new division was intended to replenish part of the enormous losses in manpower suffered on the Eastern Front. The Soviet forces were at this late stage of the war superior in numbers and materials to the forces of the Reich and its remaining allies. Jack and his comrades duly volunteered for service in the Waffen-SS and marched to fight the Russians. Jack von Spengen was young, but dedicated. He participated in several heavy engagements and was promoted to SS Sturmman for his bravery. Then, at a place several hundred miles west of his former farm settlement, he went into action for the last time. Jack would be so terribly wounded that he would remain an invalid for the rest of his life. The battalion to which he belonged received orders to protect a general retreat to a new defence line by staging a rearguard action. This meant that the young soldiers, armed only with K-98 rifles, MG-42 light machine guns, and single-shot Panzerfaust anti-tank rockets, had to fight and hold their positions against waves of motorized Russian infantry and tanks until the German division had reached its new positions. Such a mission called for great courage and determination in the face of overwhelming odds and heavy losses. When finally the battalion received radio permission to withdraw, the situation was desperate indeed. Mounting the few armoured vehicles left, the retreat began. It was at this moment that Jack was badly hit in the thigh by an exploding shell. The crew of one of the armoured cars saw it happen and gave Jack the chance to escape by hanging onto the side of their vehicle. Miraculously, despite the intense enemy fire, the battalion reached the new German lines, by which time Jack had lapsed into unconsciousness. He was transported quickly to a poorly equipped emergency field hospital. His condition was not good. With so many casualties coming in, the surgeons could spare only a little time per man. The quickest way to save Jack's life was to amputate the shattered limb, and they cut off his leg just inches below the hip. Immediately after the operation, Jack was laid out among the other badly wounded in the field hospital due to the heavy fighting in that sector. There was no opportunity to evacuate Jack and the others to more secure and better equipped hospitals in the rear. Before the situation could be stabilized, the Russian advance broke through the lines and the field hospital was overrun by the Red Army. The Soviets were noted for the brutal way they treated German wounded, and this occasion was no exception. With a total disregard for the welfare of the injured, the Russians rounded up and marched away all the skilled surgeons and physicians to work in their own casualty stations. The handful of German medical orderlies and Red Cross male nurses left behind had to care for all the German wounded. Later, the Russian soldiers checked every patient's left upper arm in order to find the SS blood group tattoos. Then, every wounded SS man was shot where he lay. Jack von Spengen was extremely lucky because of the circumstances under which he had joined the Waffen-SS. There had been no time to tattoo the volunteers. The Russians passed over Jack, and he was spared instant execution. However, it appeared he would die anyway because of the inadequate medical treatment, no medicines, and virtually no food. Jack remained either unconscious or semi-conscious most of the time. Then, as the fighting drew to a close in May 1945, a mysterious exchange of prisoners took place between the Red Army and the Western Allied forces. All the surviving patients of Jack's hospital were handed over to the Americans. The Americans were more merciful than the Soviets, and Jack, the half-dead 17-year-old, was put into intensive care quarters. Slowly, he recovered, and when he was able to stumble around on crutches, he was transferred to the Netherlands. The return home was something that Jack never spoke about. In those Dutch families split by different political causes during wartime, the homecoming of former SS volunteers was never easy. Jack's parents treated him as an outcast. They would have preferred that he had never returned, and yet Jack survived. He developed his talents, took up training from his boyhood technical school, and became a skilled repairman in all technical fields. At the same time as Jack was rebuilding his life, the Underground Mutual Support Organization for former soldiers in the German forces was founded. The LIOT found Jack, just as they would later track down Ed on his release from prison. The famous Jan Hartmann, founder and head of the LIOT, took care of Jack's medical treatment and arranged for an artificial leg for him through the offices of the larger sister organization in Germany. Despite his obvious handicap, Jack was still a young man and attractive to women. He soon married, and his home became a meeting place for loyal SS men. Although Jack was now able to enjoy a happy life, the pressure of Zionist and democratic political groups on former SS men and Dutch collaborators proved too much for Jack's wife. The harassment of Jack and his refusal to abandon his old loyalties in the face of such pressure finally split his marriage. His wife left him and took his beloved daughter with her. The loss of his family was a bitter blow, but Jack remained loyal and true to his cause. Jack von Spengen continued to be an active National Socialist. He became spiritual leader to the Flemish Dutch Viking Youth Organization and a valued member of the Northern League. When the Viking Youth came under extreme pressure from the Zionists and democratic authorities, Jack founded a covering group, the underground club, Mutua Fides. Jack put most of his money he earned as a builder of the Schlotterplatz yacht harbour and as a technical manager in the factory of Mrs. Rost van Toningem into his political projects. For the years that followed, Jack lived with a much younger woman of German origin until his health deteriorated through an incurable blood disease, and then she left him. Despite this downturn in his health, Jack continued to work politically. When Jan Hartmann died, Jack worked with Hartmann's widow in the Jan Hartmann Foundation to continue the support network. As the years took their toll, the numbers of ex-Waffen-SS and Wehrmacht reduced until the foundation existed only as a gathering centre for those loyal veterans still living. 3 years before his death, Jack remarried to a younger woman. His wife gave birth to 2 children, a son named Siegfried and a daughter called Sieglinde. In ill health and with a young family, Jack dare not take the risk of continuing to live in Amsterdam, where he was well known for his National Socialist background, so they moved to a small village where nobody knew them. Tragically, within a short time of starting this new life, Jack von Spengen died of a sudden heart attack. The final shot against the SS Sturman came from his own heart. In Ed Volsink's own words, "The SS and many of its descendant organizations in many countries of Western Europe will remember Jack von Spengen forever. His honor was his loyalty." Ed Volsink died in late December 1995 after many months of painful illness. His passing on December 30, 1995 was not officially announced until early January 1996 in order to avoid the inevitable media scramble and unwanted intrusion of strangers into his family's private grief. His funeral was a small private affair. However, the sad news of his death was broadcast worldwide to his many political contacts and friends. The illness, which had increasingly restricted Ed's activities over the last 5 years of his life, was directly connected to the wounds he had received in combat, to the fever he had caught in the swamps of Russia, and to the starvation and ill treatment he received as a prisoner in the post-war camps. The last time that the author of this book interviewed Ed was in the autumn of 1994. He was housebound and suffering great pain. The interview lasted little more than an hour, and the effort took a heavy toll on the old fighter. The death of Ed Volsink was a landmark in the history of post-war National Socialism. Ed was one of a handful of surviving Dutch Algemene SS officers and one of the last of the original werewolf. He took many secrets with him to the grave. Other secrets had been passed on to younger comrades in the Netherlands, Germany, and Britain. He was aware that the manuscript of his life story would probably not appear in print until years after his death. Ed, or Gerrit, Volsink's death was announced in numerous modern National Socialist publications, where fitting tributes to his service and sacrifices were made, and he also received scathing obituaries in a number of so-called anti-fascist publications, which was to be expected. The author of this book has tried to do justice to the memory of an unusual and courageous man. In the preparation of this book, he also became a friend, and the old Frontkämpfer, who will always be remembered with affection, is greatly missed.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.